TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate scientist Kevin Anderson on the unforgiving math for staying under 2 degrees. Much was made of the April 22, 2016 signing of the climate treaty negotiated in Paris last December. At the ceremony in New York, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that we are in a race against time and that the window for the goals set in Paris for keeping global temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius, let alone 1.5 degrees, is rapidly closing. During the negotiations in Paris in December 2015, some scientists had already warned that even a 2 degrees Celsius limit in temperature would be almost impossible to maintain unless we were to make significant changes within the next 5 years. Kevin Anderson is one extraordinary and important voice among them. Anderson is professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester. He has recently finished a 2-year position as director of the Tyndall Centre, the UK's leading academic climate change research organization. Anderson grew up next door to a nuclear power station where his father worked. Before getting his PhD, Anderson became an engineer, apprenticing on ships. He later worked in the oil industry and on drilling platforms. From 1990 on, he dedicated his life to understanding and publishing about climate change. Anderson was interviewed in Paris during the COP21 conference by Kevin Caners, radio producer with his blog, The Elephant. I found his informative and thought-provoking interview online and asked and received permission to rebroadcast. Caners' blog, The Elephant, focuses on the threat to our planet by human-induced climate change. Caners sees this challenge as interwoven with every aspect of our societies, our lives, and our civilization. Caners attended the Paris negotiations of December 2015 and observed how 195 countries agreed that they would keep average global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. But he asked himself what science has to say on actually keeping those goals. And how fast and by how much will we have to cut our emissions to get there? Caners says he chose to interview Kevin Anderson because that is exactly the area Anderson works in. He met up with him in the hallway of one of the assembly centers in Paris in December 2015. Here's Caners introducing his interview of Professor Anderson.
Kevin takes what we know from climate science and applies knowledge from other fields, like engineering and policy. He does this to map out various scenarios or emissions curves that would allow us to stay within our carbon budget and have a high probability of meeting the goals we've set. And I'm afraid he doesn't have good news for us. You see, the thing is, we've waited a really long time.
All of your life, people of my generation have chosen to do absolutely nothing about climate change. A quarter of a century. Worse than doing nothing, we've actually watched the emissions go up.
In fact, we've waited so long that despite what we agreed to in Paris, the window for us to actually be able to meet 2 degrees is extremely tight. And that window is closing quickly. So quickly that many scientists wonder if we can meet it at all. Kevin points out that climate change isn't about 2100 or the next 50 years. Because not only has it already arrived, due to the carbon budget we have left, it's really the next 5 years that will determine what kind of world we're left with for generations to come. One of the primary things you do is you look at the official targets, like 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, and then sort of reverse engineer it and say, well, what would that mean to get there? Can you just describe a bit about what that work involves?
Yes. Let's just take the 2 degrees C target. We have a 2 degrees C, and I don't like calling it a target. I see it's an obligation or a duty. If you look at the language that was wrapped around it, it was never about a target. It was, we will take the action. Not we may take the action, we'll try and take the action. It's we will take the action to keep the temperature below 2 degrees centigrade. So let's be clear, the 2 degrees C framing is not something that scientists derived. It is something that came out of civil society. Science informs that debate. Science can tell you what the impacts might be at certain temperatures in certain parts of the world, that sort of thing. But whether that set of impacts are seen to be dangerous or not is the role of civil society and the sort of messy process of international negotiations. And unfortunately, that messy process has been dominated, if we're blunt about it, by rich, white, generally men in the Northern Hemisphere. And we now have this target of 2 degrees C. And what we're hearing here in Paris is that there are many people around the world who think we should go for a lower target of 1.5. And that they have a very legitimate case for that. Nevertheless, we have this agreement around 2 degrees C, even though, as I say, it's 2 degrees C is likely to be dangerous and deadly for many of the poorer communities. It's then the role of people like me to take that and say, well, what does science tell us about 2 degrees C, what we'd need to deliver in terms of emission reductions? Now, the science tells us very clearly, and particularly the latest IPCC report, that for a temperature rise across the century, we have a set carbon budget, a total amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit into the atmosphere. And then we can, quite easily as scientists, we can start to translate to what does that mean in terms of the mitigation rates, how fast we have to reduce our emissions. We know what the current level of emissions are. We might make some assumptions about emissions from, say, deforestation or from cement use, so we can then work out what's the emissions from energy, the bit I focus on. So we might make certain sets of assumptions, but they can be very clear and obvious assumptions. You can adjust those a little bit up and down. But in the end of the day, we have a very clear carbon budget, and whenever you adjust these bits of detail, the same message comes out. We need rapid and deep reductions, probably bordering on the 10% per annum level.
Yeah. Let me pick back up on that in a second, but first let me get this idea of the carbon budget straight. So basically we can calculate more or less how much carbon we can collectively burn until we definitely go over that 2 degree line?
Yes. I mean, there's a bit more to it than that, but yes. If we're talking about stabilizing atmospheric temperature of a 2 degrees C rise by the end of the century, we have a set of carbon budgets. Now, they vary a bit with the probability. Do you want a very good chance of it? So it's not really a very good chance, but the best that we're using is a 66% chance of staying below 2 degrees C, or do you want a 50-50 chance, or just a 30% chance of staying below 2 degrees C? And they all have a different carbon budget associated with them. And that is the total amount of carbon dioxide we can emit into the atmosphere between 2011 and 2100. That's the budget range they've given in the IPCC report. And we understand that fairly clearly, and there is a very high correlation between temperature and the total amount of CO2 we put in the atmosphere.
So when you crunch the numbers and kind of look at the carbon budget that would keep us below this threshold, what do you come away with?
Okay, well, firstly, there's very little of the carbon budget left. We are in now 2015, with the end of 2015, and the carbon budgets in the IPCC report are from 2011. So we've already emitted, since 2011, 150 billion tons of carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. Now that's 15% of the budget for a good chance of 2 degrees C, gone. So you always have to say, well, that's already spent. If you imagine it like a bank balance, that £15 out of your £100 in the bank has now gone.
And how much carbon are we burning a year right now?
About 36, 37, something like that, billion tons of carbon dioxide. So at the current rate, it would take about under 20 years. At current consumption rates, it would be under 20 years. And then the budget would have gone completely. We can also then look at who are the people burning that carbon dioxide. And we can understand that either from a country level, which I understand it with a reasonable level, a very good level of detail. So how much of it is in the EU or the US or China or Tanzania or whatever it might be. So we understand that fairly well. Or the very recent work that's been done by Chancel and Piketty, which actually says, and also a report from Oxfam whilst we've been here, says, well, but who does it come from? And they show that 50% of the emissions come from 10% of the population. They show that the top 1% of emitters in the US have emissions that are 2,500 times higher than the bottom 1% globally. So you can then start to say, well, it's not just about national boundaries, it's actually about the people who are high emitters, and we can identify who they are quite well. So, looking at those sorts of things can help you understand what the policies would have to be, either at a national level or beyond that, to think about how do you develop policies that focus particularly on these high emitting people. So that's the sort of work that I'm involved with.
So it sounds like that involves a lot of thinking about power then.
It does. I mean, Even if you know, even if you only think about it from a mathematical sense, you can say, here's a particular group who have very high emissions. And if their emissions are so high, you think, well, it doesn't matter about the rest of the population. This is the group that really matters. Then, yeah, that they are in positions of power, that they are very influential people is almost separate. If you're serious about 2 degrees centigrade, I can sort of say, well, if 2 degrees C has to be achieved, have a certain carbon budget, these people are responsible for the lion's share of that carbon budget. I have to say that we have to come up with mechanisms that will bring the emissions down from that particular group. So if you like, the maths forces you into questioning these issues of power. And it may well be that these particular groups, it is the case, that these particular groups will respond to certain types of policies differently to how other groups may respond, which is one of the reasons I'm not a great advocate of a simple carbon price.
Because?
Because at least the way that most people have thought about carbon prices, if you put a carbon price on energy, the price of energy goes up. But people like me and the high emitters are inelastic to the price of energy. If our flights go up the price by 25%, so what? We still fly. If our car fuel goes up by 25%, we just drive the same large cars. We don't significantly change what we do. The price of carbon goes up. That means the price of fertilizer goes up, because that takes a lot of energy to make fertilizer. That means the price of food goes up, which means the poor people can buy less food. If the price of energy goes up, 20% of all houses in the UK are in fuel poverty. That means they cannot heat their houses adequately in the winter. So there's a real equity implication of price. We have to certainly have to think beyond a simple, let's just add a carbon price, and that would be enough. It will be very inequitable. And actually, I don't think it will really drive the emissions down very significantly in terms of behaviour and so forth. It may help us move our energy systems from, say, coal towards gas, or if the price was high enough, maybe, you know, towards renewables. But it has to be a very high carbon price. But then you sort of say, well, that has these other impacts elsewhere. And that's why I'm saying the policies need to be much more subtle and nuanced than a simple carbon tax.
Well, we talked to James Hansen the other night, and he was talking very specifically about doing a revenue neutral carbon tax.
Yeah. I think actually, oddly enough, although I've really been quite opposed to a price mechanism for a long time, including emissions trading, I don't particularly like. Nevertheless, I think the idea popularized by Hansen, I don't think it was his originally, but I mean that idea of fee and dividend is when you initially look at it, it's quite attractive. The idea that if you consume more energy and therefore emit more carbon, that you would pay a large sum of money for that, and then that money is distributed out evenly across all of society, helps overcome some of the equity implications of a high carbon price. There is the practical part of that. Can you imagine applying that globally? Could you imagine the US saying, we're happy to see huge amounts of money going to Ghana or Nigeria or wherever else it would be? So I think at a global level, it becomes quite challenging to know how you apply that.
But at a national level?
I would like to think you could imagine it being applied at national level. I'd be interested to know whether in the States that would be the case. You can imagine, yeah, the Republicans, or indeed, you know, the Democrats as well, these would be that very high emitting group. And if they're serious about 2 degrees C, the carbon price would be huge. It wouldn't just be $10, $20, $50. I would think if we're serious about 2 degrees C carbon budgets, that carbon price would have to be in the hundreds and hundreds of dollars to meet the carbon budgets that we have. And remember, it's the policymakers who would have to pay that very high carbon tax, who would have to pass it as well, because they're the ones that are going to be the high emitting group.
What would you say to people who say that, you know, 2 degrees of global temperature rise, that doesn't actually sound like that much?
Well, coming from the northwest of the UK, 2 degrees C sounds quite pleasant. We'd like a bit of warming, really. But then you start to think, but what does it really mean globally? It is a very significant temperature increase. 2 degrees C is a global average. That's about 6 degrees in the poles. So that means we will melt the Arctic for a considerable period of the year. So it's a huge temperature rise. But also, we don't live in global averages. We live in weather. We don't live in climate, we live in weather. And you have to then ask, well, what would these global averages of 2 degrees C mean for the extreme weather events? They're the ones that cause us real problems. When we see extreme weather, there would be a climate signal on top of that. And you start to think, well, that would be a considerable additional flooding in some parts of the world, droughts, prolonged heat waves, changes in food patterns, changes in rainfall around the planet. And we all have learned to live with our current climate. Our infrastructures have evolved. You look at somewhere like a lot of Europe, not continental Europe particularly, the infrastructures have evolved over hundreds of years of a particular form of climate. And so when that climate changes and when you start to get these extreme weather events, our infrastructures have not been developed for that. And that's not just our technical infrastructures, but our social infrastructures, like our agricultural framing and all of that sort of thing. So actually 2 degrees C is not this, you know, on a cold day in Manchester sounds quite pleasant. It's nothing like that. I mean, it is a fundamental change in the shape of our planet in many respects. If you head to something like 4 degrees C, it's almost like another planet. I mean, it's living somewhere that looks very different and feels very different from the world in which we live. And also, we have to be careful that the 2 degrees C, the northern hemisphere, we like to think that we can, you know, think that we can probably just buy our way out of it. I still think many of the poorer people in the in the Northern Hemisphere will still struggle at 2 degrees C. Will certainly struggle a lot at 2 degrees C. But the poorer people in the climatically vulnerable parts of the world, 30 million people living on the coastal strip of Bangladesh within a metre of sea level rise and already susceptible to typhoons that will increase in severity and possibly frequency with increased climate change, their lives are going to be made even more unbearable. So people who are already struggling with the current climate are going to find their lives much more challenged. Yeah, and let's be really clear and blunt about this. Many millions of people will die if we don't do something about climate change. You know, 2, 3, 4 degrees C, we are talking about millions and millions of people, possibly billions of people being affected. You know, we have to accept the fact that many people will suffer the implications of this, and they are already suffering the implications of just a 1 degree temperature rise.
1 degree is what we have so far?
1 degree is about the warming that we've seen so far, yes.
So if we're talking about millions, potentially billions of people being affected, why do you think we've responded collectively with mostly a shrug?
Because we're not prepared to question our current economic and political paradigm. We have this particular way of viewing the world, and that has become so dominant. It's more important than physics and maths. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, set down by God, this is how the world has to be, and you must not question it. And scientists feel constrained by the fact that they feel they can't really question this, so they're always trying to fine-tune certain sets of assumptions to make sure it delivers within the current political paradigm. Our policymakers like it because it means they haven't got to put forward, you know, very stringent policies. We like it as a scientific community because we can carry on flying to our nice climate change conferences all around the world. The public like it because they can carry on going on their holidays and buy their cars and not have to worry about this sort of agenda. You know, when we think about carbon, it's in every facet of our life. It's in the dyes that make up my coat here. It's how we travel to this event here. It's in the varnish that's on the seats that we're sat on now. Every part of our life has been influenced by carbon, fossil fuel-based carbon. And we're talking about trying to take that out of the system in 20, 30, 40 years at the very outside, maybe 20, 30 years. This is a huge challenge. We've never faced anything like that, let alone faced it when you've got 7 billion people on the planet. And you put all of that together, you know, and tie that in with our current economic paradigm. No one really wants to stand up and say, I'll start to show some leadership on this. I'll start to, you know, make the sorts of changes that are necessary. And even the NGOs have been co-opted really in this, you know, much of the time. They're all part of the same quite upbeat, optimistic view that technology in the future will solve the problem for us. And as an engineer, I really wish that was the case. You know, I spent a lot of my life working on large pieces of engineering equipment, designing and constructing them. And I wish we could simply engineer our way out of this problem. Engineering is an important part of getting out of this problem, but it is nowhere near enough. It has huge social, political, moral, and philosophical repercussions now.
Geoengineering, you mean?
Simply engineering in terms of things like renewable energy. I mean, that's a big engineering task. You know, if you think, you know, nuclear power is very low, it has lots of other problems with it, but, you know, again, that's a big engineering task. Engineering low-carbon transport networks, improving rail networks, building houses that are very low energy consumption or zero energy consumption, hopefully even generate energy. All of this is engineering that we should be doing. I wasn't particularly thinking about geoengineering or negative emission technologies. I think they're part of the problem. People think we can do all of this engineering very quickly. I was in an event today and someone was saying, well, we can just do it all with renewable power. I'm all for renewable power. But just be realistic. We cannot build enough renewable power to get us off the curve or down to the curve that would be necessary for 2 degrees centigrade. We just can't physically do that. And therefore, in the interim, because we've left it so late, we have to reduce our levels of energy demand. The wealthy of us have to make very significant reductions. If we started this in 1990, when the first IPCC report came out, a quarter of a century ago, I don't know how old you are, but you were probably very young a quarter of a century ago, we've had all of that time to do something about it. So virtually all of your life, people of my generation have chosen to do absolutely nothing about climate change. A quarter of a century. Worse than doing nothing, we've actually watched the emissions go up. So this year, the emissions will be 60% higher than they were a quarter of a century ago. That shows how much we've cared about climate change.
So you mean even if we were to take all the policies that people would be advocating with building renewables and putting in a high carbon tax or whatever, even then we couldn't reduce it fast enough, you don't think, just with building solar and wind?
No, nowhere near fast enough. No.
Just because of the lag time?
Yeah, because of the lag time. But don't we just think, solar and wind, great. Both, I'm really for solar and wind, and they're wonderful technologies. Their price is really coming down. How do you fly your planes with those? Are you going to power all your ships traveling around the world with solar and wind? How about all the car infrastructure? Is that going to go overnight to solar and wind? You know, electricity is 20% of the energy we consume. 80% of the energy we consume is not electricity. Now, fine, we can convert a lot of that to electric and then make it more renewable. But that's not a 5-minute job, building a grid network that is 3, 4, 5 times bigger than one we have today that can deal with some of the intermittency issues, which have been exaggerated by some people. But nevertheless, there's a different performance structure to a performance output from renewable type power to the sort of typical thermal power stations we've been more used to.
So what makes up the other 80% then? Transportation mostly or what?
Well, gas for heating, transportation, our aircraft, our ships. Industry requires lots of direct energy use, there's gas, sometimes coal, sometimes oil. So that's 80% of the energy is not electricity. And I think most people forget that. And a lot of the NGOs forget that. And they talk about energy and electricity as if they're the same thing. They both begin in E and end in Y, but they're quite different. Now, we can electrify a lot of the other part of the system, but that is not a five-minute job. That is going to take us quite a lot of years to do that. And even if we had, as I often call it, a Marshall-style plan, which is like the reconstruction after the Second World War, if we were that concerned about climate change and we really put all of our efforts into constructing a low-carbon physical infrastructure, that will still take us too long for the carbon budgets that we have left. So it is a prerequisite. We have to do that, but we also, therefore, have to reduce our energy consumption in the short term. And whilst we reduce our energy consumption, and that energy is primarily fossil fuel, we will reduce our carbon dioxide emissions.
So you're saying there's a huge cognitive dissonance, even among people who are really involved with this issue?
Oh, yes. I mean, I often use that in my slides, this idea of a cognitive dissonance, or I say a fancy academic term for hypocrisy a lot of the time. There's many of us actually aware of this. But having said that, many people also are not. I mean, a lot of climate scientists work in their particular area of climate science. They're not experts in the broader issues of mitigation or the broader issues of climate change. And they make quite often naive assumptions about the world outside.
What are those naive assumptions about the world outside?
Well, often about how fast you can put technologies in place. So a lot of scientists I engage with, really, I get the impression that they've never really done any engineering. They've never been involved in any building anything. It takes a long time to build something. And you don't just do it one power station or two power stations or 30 power stations or one or two new train lines. You're doing it across the full swathe of infrastructure, trying to convert it all to low carbon in 20 to 30 years. Now, that is a Herculean engineering task. So we can use carbon capture and storage. We can use all of these other renewable technologies. They take a long time to put in place. Solar is interesting, and it's been put out much quicker than anyone expected, and it's much cheaper. And I'm not saying we can't do things much quicker, and I'm very much in favour of us shifting towards renewables like there's no tomorrow. All I'm simply saying is, even when we do the best we could possibly imagine, it's nowhere near enough to get us to the 2°C carbon budget. And if we're serious about 2°C, therefore, in the interim, we have to reduce our energy consumption. It can go back up again when we have low carbon energy supply. We can go back to all of the inequalities and all the other things that we have in our lives if we think that's really worth having. Imagine a car with five seats having more than one person in it. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine when you look at Europe nowadays or the US. You have a big car, there's only ever one person in it. We have to find some way out of this, that we start to learn to be more, not necessarily more communal, but at least more aware of the energy we use when we try and do something. At the moment, when you think about when we travel short distances, what do? We get 90 kilograms, in my case, 93 kilograms of flesh. You get in a car that weighs 1,500 kilograms and you drive 7 kilometers to pick up some groceries. In 2015, can we not find a better way to pick up 10 kilograms of groceries than having to transport 1,500 kilograms of metal to a supermarket and then bring it back again?
But if that's necessary right now, we have a pretty big gap there from what is politically even anywhere feasible and what you're saying is necessary that we do right this minute.
I don't think we're going to succeed at this. I mean, we cannot guarantee we will fail because we haven't tried. If we tried, we may well find that we don't succeed. But if we don't try, we're guaranteed to fail. If we are serious about 2 degrees centigrade, we have to acknowledge that and say we are going to deal with it. Otherwise, let's be honest and say we're not going to aim for 2, we're going to aim for 3 or 4 and just tell the poor people elsewhere in the world, well, forget it, we're not worried about your future. Let us be honest about that. That's really the underlying text from Paris. We don't really care about the poor and vulnerable elsewhere. So the real message coming out of something like this is the wealthy parts of the world who are responsible for the lion's share of the emissions, or even the wealthier within the poorer parts of the world as well. We just don't care about the people who are going to be impacted by climate change. That's the real take-home message.
That's a level of honesty that also doesn't seem very feasible.
Well, it is a level of honesty. I mean, okay, so what we're always saying then is that we can only carry on by being dishonest. I mean, I think humanity can be more than that. I think humanity can be honest. I think humanity can make very significant changes. I mean, even just a very simple thing, to put a bit of maths on some of this. If we took the top 10% of the global population, not the other 90%, the top 10% of high emitters, and these are around the globe, significant in the US and the EU and so forth, but also a significant number of people in China and India as elsewhere. But let's imagine that top 10% could reduce their emissions down to the level of the average European. Now, that's not impoverished. That's not a bad quality of life, the average European. And they could achieve that in a year. That would be a 30% reduction in global emissions. They wouldn't like it. That would mean they would have to have only one or two flights a year, and they would probably maybe only one flight a year. They'd have to start living like an average European lives.
Isn't it a lot of it from just the built-in infrastructure and way things have been designed?
Not really. The top 10% are there, not because of the infrastructure. They use the same infrastructure you'd be using. When they're on the road, one person might be traveling on that road on a bus, one person might be traveling along that road on a bike, another person might be traveling in a car that does 100 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometer, or the American car that's averaging 220 grams of carbon dioxide per kilometer. So there are huge different ways, all traveling along the road, all traveling the same 7 kilometers to pick up their groceries or whatever they're going to do. Just same road, same grocery shop at the end. People do the same things using very different levels of energy. Now, if we cannot be even bothered to say that the people responsible for 50% of global emissions can even be bothered to make that level of reduction, then okay, let's accept the fact 3 or 4 degrees C, let's tell the poor we don't care about their futures, and we can just get on living our lives and enjoy it whilst, you know, whilst the sun shines, and let the temperatures keep going up.
I heard you say in a talk that one of the primary things that people misunderstand is that it's not about targets even in like 2050, it's about right now, like the next 5 years, that will determine whether or not we even have a chance of getting to 2 degrees.
This comes back to this idea about carbon budgets. For a long time, people have actually focused on these long-term targets.
Well, like 80% by
2050. 80% by 2050, yeah. So that's the sort of argument we've had in the UK. We've had that enshrined in law in the UK. An 80% reduction by 2050.
You know, it feels far away.
It feels a long way away. A technology in 2030 and 2040 will solve the problem for us. The problem is there's no science to that. The science has told us very clearly we have a carbon budget. If we'd started to act a long time ago, we could have introduced more sort of gradual policies and so forth. We've squandered almost all of our carbon budget for 2 degrees centigrade, and therefore we now face these dire political repercussions that are about today. Because in 5 years from now, we'll effectively have wiped out any chance for 2 degrees centigrade. If we do not do something very significant from a policy perspective over the next few years that start to bring our emissions down, then the 2 degrees centigrade framework has basically gone. So we haven't got another 5 years to wait. Paris is the last major COP where we have any opportunity to do something on 2 degrees C. And we're not even there. We're still talking about a very thin probability now. So the reason it shifted from an 80% reduction by 2050 to actually these carbon budgets is that the carbon budgets are the scientific way to think about temperature. This way of delaying action until some technology will solve the problem in 2050, that means the carbon dioxide emissions keep rising in the atmosphere. And that's all that matters for climate change, you know, the level of CO2 in the atmosphere. So whether we keep pumping CO2 in the atmosphere and make some big reductions in 2030 or 2040 or 2050, too late. The carbon dioxide is there, changing the atmosphere, changing the climate for the next 100 to 10,000 years. And because we've left it so late, we have this very small carbon budget now, and that's why it comes, you know, it's incumbent on the current generation to do something about it in the next few years.
That was part one of an hour-long conversation between Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, and Kevin Kainers. Kainers blogs under The Elephant from Berlin, Germany. They met up in the hallway of one of the conference centers at the International Climate Summit, COP21, in Paris in December 2015. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. Thanks to Kevin Kainers for allowing me to rebroadcast his extraordinary interview. A slightly longer version is posted at his blog, The Elephant. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.